You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Alexander the Great's military and political conquests have been a favorite topic of historians throughout the ages, but the story of the dissolution of his hard-won and enormous empire in the wake of his death is less well-known. Now, in his latest book, Ghosts on the Throne, historian and Bard College Classics professor James Rahm tells a story of intrigue, ambition, and rebellion after Alexander's death. It's published by Knopf, and we are re-airing my interview with Professor Rahm in November. I began by asking him, Alexander's story is quite well known, the taming of the horse Bucephalus and his tutoring by Aristotle to the cutting of the Gordian knot, but why is what happened to his empire when he was ill and after he died less known?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is simply that his life is so compelling that most writers want to tell that story and most readers want to read that story, and the story ends with his death. I think there's an equally compelling story that starts at that point. But the second reason is it's a very complex story. It's an ensemble cast. There's not a single dominant individual.
But it leads us to the story of Cleopatra later in Egypt, doesn't it?
And yes.
All sorts of other interesting things that we are interested in.
That's right. It sets up three centuries of the history of the Middle East, Egypt, and Eastern Europe.
Were people writing this history at the time?
Yes. There was one eyewitness to the major events of my period, a man named Hieronymus, whose work unfortunately perished between late antiquity and the Middle Ages. But fortunately, five other writers drew on that memoir and preserved substantial portions of it.
How far did Alexander's empire extend at the time of his death?
From approximately the Adriatic to the eastern Indus Valley, the very eastern border of Pakistan today, about 2 million square miles.
And how does that compare with some of the other great empires? Well, smaller than the Roman.
Smaller than the Roman.
What about Napoleon?
You know, I've never done a mile-for-mile comparison, but it was certainly the biggest of its day. It was the biggest the ancient world had ever seen.
And was he planning to go on if he hadn't died?
Yes, he was.
What drove him to want to do that?
I think a restlessness, what the Greeks called pathos, a yearning always to do more and be better. It was just in his nature never to stop, never to settle. And he apparently had plans at the time of his death to go west from Babylon and conquer the Mediterranean basin.
Mm.
So he was only half done.
So he'd gone into India, and
yes.
And then he'd went back to Babylon.
Right.
And then he was going to go, what, to Egypt and...
Well, Arabia was his first objective because the Arabians had not paid him homage, and he thought perhaps they would be enemies. So he had an Arabian campaign planned at the time of his death. But from there, he apparently intended to go to the Mediterranean.
And this didn't sit well with everyone in his army, did it?
You know, it's not clear.
He was facing a mutiny in India, wasn't he?
Yes, he did. His troops mutinied in India, forced him to turn back towards the west. And he was enormously angry and put out by that. It's not clear when he got to Babylon what their attitude was. Immediately after his death, they quashed his plan for further conquest. So it seems as if they were fatigued and willing to stop with what they had.
Wasn't there also a Macedonian versus the other people aspect to this? Some people were upset that he recruited Persians and Bactrians and was training them and enrolling them in some of the most elite units.
That's right. Yes, there's a racial element to this story that I try to bring out in my book. The tension between the progressives in his army, the higher officers who wanted to try to fuse European and Asian cultures into a single world culture, and the rank-and-file soldiers who were very mistrustful of that.
He also pursued a policy of intermarrying with the ruling classes of the Asian nations that he conquered.
That's right.
Was that unusual at the time?
Yes, very unusual.
But it was a way of ensuring that people would stay with him? As their ruler?
That the Persians in particular would stay with him. He knew that he couldn't rule a three-continent empire as a European monarch operating in a European fashion with only European high command. he had to integrate if he was going to be successful.
Well, the Persian Empire was one of the most powerful empires in the world at the time, and they had been at war with Athens in the past. How was he able to conquer them?
Well, that's a story of mainly for military history. His army, which was formed by his father Philip, was undoubtedly the most potent force that the ancient world had ever seen. Their tactics and weaponry and training, mostly training, were superior to anything that had been seen.
And he relied on his cavalry.
His cavalry was his striking arm, which won the battles, but they relied also on the infantry phalanx as a sort of anchor for the battle line.
Did he so-called go native?
To a limited degree. He incorporated Persian dress, Persian customs, and married Persian women. So his court became a sort of mixed affair in a deliberate attempt to integrate Persians into his high command.
But one of his most important generals, Craterus, was openly critical of these policies, wasn't he? Why?
For the same reason that we have, racial tensions today or nativists versus internationalists. There were some who felt that this was a Macedonian victory and a Macedonian empire and didn't have to be shared with the Persians.
Well, did he have to take Craterus seriously? How important was he?
Craterus was very important. He was beloved of the army. He was by far the most popular of the generals. And I think it was probably with some reluctance that Alexander sent him home the year before his death to take command in Europe as a deliberate move to discharge him, essentially, from the Eastern campaign.
During all of this, Alexander was seriously wounded in battle, but that's not what led to his death, was it?
It may have been a factor. He was wounded in the lung in India 2 years before his death and almost died at that point.
And there were rumors that he had died.
Yes, there were.
How did his troops respond?
Well, there was an immediate rebellion in Bactria, what is now Afghanistan, among the Greeks who were manning the garrisons there. 3,000 of them just up and left, thinking that with Alexander gone, they wouldn't be punished. So there were signs right there that his empire couldn't hold together after his death.
And he did punish people who went up against him back home in Greece as well.
Yes, indeed. Yes, he relied on collective punishment and making examples of rebellious cities to keep his empire in line.
The Thebes revolted when they had heard false rumors that Alexander had died. How did he punish them?
He destroyed the entire city. He left only one house standing, apparently, the house of the poet Pindar, to show his respect for Greek literary tradition. But otherwise, he left it a ruin.
And then the Athenians decided not to revolt until they were sure that he died.
Yes.
Because they feared something similar to what happened at Thebes?
Yes. The punishment of Thebes managed to keep most of the Greek world in line during Alexander's lifetime. But as soon as his death was reported in Athens, that city launched a revolt, which is a major subplot of my book, the Hellenic War, as they called it, to free themselves from Macedonian control.
How was Aristotle affected by the death of Alexander?
Very negatively. He was perceived in Athens as a Macedonian agent, or even perhaps a Macedonian citizen, because of his links to Alexander and the royal house of Macedon. And as soon as Alexander's death was reported and the revolt was launched, he was persona non grata. He had to leave the city.
Even though he was considered one of the great thinkers of the time, and he was not Macedonian. He had been brought into Macedonia as Alexander's tutor.
That's right. It was guilt by association. He'd just spent too much time in the royal household to not to be tarred with that brush.
My guest is James Rahm, who is the James H. Ottaway Jr. Professor of Classics at Bard College. His book, Ghost on the Throne, The Death of Alexander the Great and the War for Crown and Empire, it's published by Knopf. How did Alexander become ill?
Apparently, he contracted a tropical illness, and perhaps there was a secondary infection from his lung wound that contributed to his death.
Even though he had survived the lung wound, and we're talking about a year later or 2 years later.
This was a while later, but presumably it had never fully healed.
Did anyone suspect foul play, that he might have been poisoned?
Yes, and there are still some who suspect it today, and I deal with that rumor in my book because it's important to understand the politics of the era, that certain members of the high command were suspected of being assassins, and that colored the outcome of the struggle for succession.
I've also read that, and one explanation was that the death of Hephaestion, his closest friend, shattered his will and mind, and that his drunken mourning destroyed his health and his body's ability to defend itself against the various prevalent diseases and the after effects of the battle wounds.
That has been called a contributing factor, his grief over the death of Hephaestion. It's hard to know, really, how much that was still affecting his state of mind a year later.
But would there have been, if it was an assassination, would there have been some likely suspects?
The likely suspect that the Greek world turned to was Antipater, the high commander of Europe, the Macedonian high commander of Europe, whom Alexander had left behind as a kind of home guard. And his son Cassander had gone from Europe to Babylon just a couple of weeks before Alexander's death. So the Greeks thought that he had, brought poison from Europe to Asia and poured it into Alexander's wine.
But usually when there is an assassination, there's a clear succession in place.
Exactly.
Was there one here?
No, and that's a principal reason why I don't credit the poisoning rumors, because I think it's implausible that these generals would have carried out an assassination with no plan for the future, no way to avoid the kind of turmoil that in fact set in just the very next day.
What's Alexander rumored to have said on his deathbed?
Well, the rumor is that he was asked to whom the empire should pass, and he said to the strongest or to the best, depending on how you translate the Greek words to kratisto. And then there's a further follow-up that he foresaw a great funeral contest would take place over his tomb, with a double meaning, referring to both the custom of holding funeral games at the death of a hero and the civil war that in fact broke out.
So he was predicting a civil war, and he wasn't doing anything to prevent it.
If you credit those rumors, the more likely account of his death, the one that I trust and I use as my main source, is that he had already lost the power of speech several days before his death, and his last few days were spent in more or less a comatose state.
So what happened in the military? Did different units take different positions as to who they wanted to be his successor?
Yes, that was the first point of difference that almost caused a civil war in the first week after June 11th, 323. The high command wanted to wait for Alexander's child to be born. His wife was pregnant at the time, and if she was going to have a son, they would have a legitimate heir. The rank and file did not accept the idea that an Asian woman could be the mother of their next king, because the mother of his child was Roxanne, a Bactrian woman.
But his brother was not an ideal candidate, Alexander's brother.
That's right. They chose his brother instead and ignored the fact that he was mentally deficient, probably developmentally disabled, and couldn't hold power either. And a compromise was forged after about a week of near warfare between the two parties, by which both monarchs would occupy the throne jointly. An infant, Roxanne's baby did turn out to be a boy, so there was a legitimate heir, but an infant, and a member of the royal family who was mentally disabled.
Well, and into this comes, now forgive me if I mispronounce every Greek name so far, Perdiccas. And he, what position did he take? He was an important figure here.
Yes, he was the senior member of the seven-man cohort called the Bodyguard, essentially Alexander's cabinet and joint chiefs of staff, and closest friends as well. Perdiccas had grown up with Alexander. They were approximately the same age. And on his sickbed, Alexander passed Perdiccas a ring, which he used to sign executive orders signaling that Perdiccas was the man to take charge, at least until a new monarch could be appointed.
Well, that sounds like succession to me, or at least naming the regent.
Yes.
And Perdiccas had other reasons a little later. He was involved with Alexander's sister, wasn't he?
Yes. There was a very close call that would have brought Cleopatra, Alexander's sister, and Perdiccas together and made a couple that could have produced a legitimate heir and provided a future for the kingdom.
Cleopatra obviously is a common name.
Yes.
Did she and her mother, Olympus, Alexander's mother, travel to Asia to arrange this marriage?
Cleopatra did, sent by Olympias, who stayed home in Europe.
But she didn't know that Perdiccas was already betrothed to the daughter of another general.
That's right. So the marital politics of this era get very complex and interesting. Perdiccas essentially had to make a choice.
He couldn't marry both women.
He couldn't marry both women, and the choice was a terrible one between the daughter of Olympias, a member of the royal family, and the daughter of Antipater, who was the most powerful non-royal among the generals. So it was basically a choice between secular power and monarchic power, and he couldn't decide.
Well, one would have given him a powerful ally, but the other one would have given him some kind of legitimate connection to the lineage of Macedonian kings.
That's right.
So what did he choose?
Well, Perdiccas shows at many points an inability to make the right choice, and in this case, he made no choice at all. He married the daughter of Antipater, but sent a secret message to Cleopatra saying he intended to renounce his wife and marry her at the first opportunity. So he essentially tried to keep both options open. But by the time he finally decided it was time to wed Cleopatra, events had turned against him, his future no longer looked so good, and Cleopatra rejected him.
Olympia wasn't the only royal mother to plan for her daughter to marry into royalty. Whom did, and I'm probably going to pronounce this name wrong too, Kinani?
Kinani.
Kinani. Actually, I think in Greek it would be Kinani.
Kinani, that's right.
Have in mind for her daughter, Adea.
Well, Kinani and Adea are a fascinating pair. They're both members of the Macedonian royal house, but come from Illyrian stock. And the Illyrians were famous for bringing up their women as warriors, something like the Amazons. And Kinani had been raised that way, and she raised her daughter Adia that way. And Adia turned out to be every bit as tough, scrappy, and ambitious as the generals who surrounded her, even though she was only 13 at the time when she entered the power struggle.
Sounds like the kind of women who inspired Euripides to write plays.
Yes, exactly. These are all characters from myth. It's really amazing that this is a true historical account.
So we're talking about a total mess here, and we have a couple of battles between Perdiccas and Ptolemy and another between Eumenes and Craterus.
And Antigonus.
Did these resolve anything?
They did. Not in the way that anyone had planned and the way that some had desperately hoped would not occur, the fragmentation of the empire. The basic split was between those who hoped to keep the empire together and fuse the continents in the way that Alexander had hoped and dreamed, and those who were more intent on seizing pieces of it and breaking it apart.
Would this all have been avoided if Alexander had married a Macedonian woman?
I don't think so, although his commanders urged him to do that. But there were grave problems involved in choosing a Macedonian bride, especially once his empire was more than three-quarters Asian and African in extent. He really had to marry an Asian bride. He married three Asian women, actually. Two of them were Persian princesses, and he hoped to beget children by them who would be the next heirs, but he never had the time.
You mentioned his funeral. Wasn't his funeral train hijacked?
Yes, it was. Yes, one of the most unexpected and dramatic events in the succession struggle was Ptolemy's hijacking of Alexander's corpse. As it was making its way to Europe from Asia, he simply stole it on the highway and brought it to Egypt to be his own personal trophy and his badge of authority.
So that's why Alexander wasn't buried in Siwa, as he had requested, or in Aegea, where all of his ancestors had been buried.
That's right.
Did this give Ptolemy legitimacy? Because when we talk about what happened afterward, we talk about the Ptolemaic split of Alexander's empire.
Yes.
So it wound up his heirs all took over different portions of the empire?
Basically, his generals. Yes, the world became divided into five kingdoms by the time my book ends. My book only covers 7 years of time, so it goes very slowly through this chain of events. But at the end of it, a rough stability has started to emerge in which five kingdoms have taken the place of one.
And Cleopatra is one of the heirs. Cleopatra, the Queen of Egypt.
The Queen of Egypt, 300 years later, is a descendant of Ptolemy the First. Yes.
Now, Eumenes is your favorite character in this drama. What was so appealing about him for you?
Well, Eumenes is a great story of the scrappy underdog who manages to hold his own amidst people much better placed and more powerful than he by sheer wit and pluck. He was Alexander's secretary for many years, didn't even have a military command until the last year of Alexander's life, but somehow proved himself to be a talented cavalry officer and came to control most of Asia for several years.
He won a decisive battle, but in the end, they all lost to Ptolemy. Is that fair to say?
Ptolemy...
Did they all get a piece of the action in one way or another?
Well, some did and some didn't. I don't want to ruin the suspense of the book because it is a story that's driven by suspense. But Ptolemy certainly came out ahead by choosing Egypt. Egypt, as everyone knew at the time, was fantastically easy to defend. So he managed to hold on where many others did not.
Well, so much of this depended on who you allied yourself with. And some people made bad decisions and lost in the end, even if they were brilliant generals.
Yes.
Now, what is the upshot of all of this? It sounds like a total mess. What goes on back in Greece, for example? What happened in Macedonia? Who took over as ruler?
Well, Olympias did for a time. By a strange series of twists and turns, Alexander's mother actually became the ruler of Macedonia, the first woman that we know of to rule on European soil. And everything might have been settled right then and there. She might have put her grandson onto the throne, Alexander's son, but for various reasons she could not hold on. So Cassander, the son of Antipater, emerges as the winner of Europe at the end of my story.
Are there still consequences from this event that are reflected in the way the world has been configured since?
Well, it involves a part of the world that's very much at the center of conflict and political realignment today. It's all takes place in the Middle East, basically. And it determined the fate of the Middle East for several centuries until the advent of Rome. And some of the borders established then are still felt today.
Well, his last conquest was Babylon, and that's Iraq, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. I mean,
do we still see traces of him in these areas?
Well, Saddam Hussein made a monument out of some of the shrines in Babylon, some of the buildings in Babylon that are associated with Alexander, and ruled by very much the same sort of cult of personality as Alexander. And perhaps the breakup of that hegemony in Iraq is in some ways similar to the breakup of Alexander's rule.
Do you think, there's no way of knowing this, of course, but do you think that if Alexander had lived, that he would have been able to manage his empire? It was quite large for the time. Or would it have fallen apart anyway because of its size and diversity? There were mutinies and all sorts of other things happening that suggest to me that he couldn't have kept this going into his 50s or 60s.
That's quite possible. It's possible that his personality was on a trajectory at the time of his death where he could not have stayed sane and rational very much longer. There's reports that he was drunk most of the time in his last year and was paranoid and brutal and perhaps was on his way toward becoming a true despot. But At the same time, he had a myth, a cult of personality, that was really the only way that this empire could have stayed together, someone with that kind of prowess and reputation.
Now, there are a couple of movies made about Alexander the Great, one with Richard Burton. Are any of them accurate?
It's a hard story to portray accurately in a movie because, for one thing, there's several battles, and they would begin to become repetitious if you were to film them all. Oliver Stone telescoped them into just two battles in his film, but really there are several more. And film can't show you the inner workings, the politics, the administrative moves, the replacement of governors with other governors, all that sort of thing, which is part of the infrastructure of the empire.
And Alexander didn't have the advantage of CGI when he was entering the battle.
That's right.
James Rahm is the James H. Ottaway Jr. Professor of Classics at Bard College. His latest book, his third, is called Ghost on the Throne, The Death of Alexander the Great and the War for Crown and Empire. It is published by Knopp. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Up next, Joan Didion discusses parenthood, her family, and losing her daughter shortly after her husband died. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.